So, Marianne, I'd love for you to share with us where geographically and how you first started gardening.
Well, as you mentioned at the start of the show, I was born and raised in Idaho. In particular, I'm from northern Idaho, from Orfino on the Clearwater River, Lewis and Clark country. But my great-grandparents also came to Idaho at the turn of the 19th century, and they homesteaded up on the Palouse, which are big grain field areas. And I learned to garden actually up there with my grandmother when I was just about 3 or 4 years old. And I have had a garden everywhere I am, everywhere I've lived, even if it was an apartment in college. And I have hauled more coleus back and forth across the country and African violets in order just to keep my plants with me. I would guess then, without giving away the whole story, I've been gardening for 50 years. And I have spent the last 20-some years working with the Idaho Botanical Garden and overseeing some projects there, all in the volunteer capacity. And then I started doing design and writing, and I have scouted for Meredith Corporation, which is Better Homes and Gardens. And now I write for a lot of national magazines.
That's great. I appreciate you sharing all of your expertise from all those years with us today. It's great to have you on. And Marianne, will you tell us what your elevation is where you garden at home and what your native soil is like there?
I'm at 2,860 feet in Boise, and I am considered high desert. There is a great deal of controversy right now over what zone we are. They say that we've moved into 7, but I have lived here when it has been at 20 below zero. So I don't recommend that people buy expensive trees or anything that won't go to a zone 5 winter. Our soil here is very lean and mean. We either have sandy soil or we have clay bathtubs, hard as rock caliche, and very little organic matter in that soil. So it either drains like crazy or you've got a bathtub full of water. So, of course, amending is generally the rule here.
Great. Okay. And then your talk today is titled Designing Contemporary Gardens with Heirloom Plants. And I wondered if you could share an aha moment you've had on your way to that talk and the understanding you have today about that subject matter.
Oh boy, it was really an aha moment. I was going to give a presentation for the Seattle, the Northwest Flower and Garden Show. Their theme a couple of years ago was Great Gardens Come to Life Through Literature. And I had always been in love with the writing of Willa Cather. And it popped into my mind that in her book, My Antonia, one of her most famous books, there was a beautiful garden that Antonia had created from scratch. And it was the life and heart of their whole family, and they had this wonderful root cellar. And I had grown up with a root cellar at my grandmother's house. So I'm reading My Antonia and trying to put together the plant list so I could create some kind of a presentation about that. And I have my list of plants as I go through the book and stuff. And I sat up. I was laying in bed reading late at night, and I sat up and I went, wow, all of this stuff, this was the original sustainable garden. What the pioneers did had to be sustainable or they didn't make it. And that was my big aha moment when I decided right then and there that I was going to investigate this. And I started doing crazy stuff like breaking and entering old homesteads and stuff that you will see like the picture there on the first slide. But it has become an adventure and a passion And it makes so much sense with the sustainability issues.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that was my aha.
Yeah, that's a great one. I like that story. It's interesting. And they, I doubt those pioneers were amending their soils.
Well, actually, they probably did. A lot of them knew, you know, they had their own chickens and mm-hmm. livestock and farm animals. So if they were going to succeed where they planted their vegetable gardens and that kind of thing, I think a good many of them knew about amending their soils. But, of course, all they had was the organic things available from the farmyard. They, I've read some interesting family histories where, you know, one year they planted the garden in one place and it failed miserably. And, of course, they couldn't afford to not have a successful garden. So they did everything they could and talked to neighbors and stuff and figured out it needed to be in a different place and that kind of thing. But the amendments were very rudimentary. Compost piles were the norm. Again, this goes back to the very essence of sustainability. You know, we don't think about this, but they didn't have grocery stores that you could go to. There'd be a general store where, in some instances, these folks maybe got there once a month. And in some cases, they only got there once every few months, and that was for things like coffee and sugar. So a lot of this stuff had to be really well thought out and anticipated. And when you're supplying your own groceries from your table, you get very, very creative and do your very best.
That's right. Yep. Well, I'm really excited about your talk today. I think that you and I are cut from the same thread or the same cloth, at least in the way of kind of sneaking into the old homesteads, like you said, to see what's still surviving. There's a nursery in town here who moved across town a couple years ago. They packed everything up in the fall, and then they cleared out, and it became a parking lot. And I snuck my way in there. I mean, the gate was open. It wasn't that hard. But anyway, I kept looking through there because I knew there were garden beds that had been tended by the nursery for years. And as I'd drive by, I'd always kind of crane my neck to see what was going on with those plants. And at one point, kind of late into the next season, when I knew they hadn't had a drop of water from any human all season, I snuck in there and took some photographs to see what was still living and thriving, and there were plenty of things, and it was really cool. There was a horseradish and a catmint and some penstemon, among a few other things. So, yeah, I'm excited to hear about what you have to share with us today, Marianne, and with that, I want to turn it over to you so we can start on the first slide of your slideshow.
Well, thank you very much, and I would do anything to see those photos that you have, because I'm kind of gathering up a whole anything I can get like that to look at, and I'm really tickled that you brought that up. I just want to say, if anybody else does this kind of thing, I'd like to start with, number one, wear a mask if you're going into these old homesteads because of mouse droppings and antivirus, and number two, make sure that you have a tetanus shot. Number three, you probably should ask permission. A lot of times there's no one around to ask permission. I don't remove anything unless I have asked permission to take a cutting or something before. Anyway, to get started with the pioneering garden story, the first slide that you'll see is a beautiful old mansion that was built in 1895 in northern Idaho. My sister-in-law pointed this out to me. It's up by Grangeville. And I actually have a photograph of this house when it was just finished, and the family, the women, are all dressed up. And they're sitting there in that bay window in their long dresses and their boots and stuff, and they're quite fetching. The problem was I couldn't get that picture to reproduce well enough to show up on a slideshow. But my sister-in-law pointed this property out to me a couple of years ago, and what she first noticed were in this lawn, and you can't see it right now, but it was full of Narcissus poeticus, which is also called the pheasant's eye narcissus, and it's a very old and very beloved, not so rare because there are a lot of them, but narcissus. And the fact is, once you see them, you start noticing them all along fence lines and in lots of places. The other plant you see right here in the front is the beautiful Harrison's yellow rose, which has been, this has been untended for 50, 60 years. So this is just an idea of some of the things that I'm discovering and that are going on my big long list of plants that we should be seeking out as good ones to use in our gardens. Here in the American West, of course, we rely so heavily on irrigation and or Mother Nature for our rain. One of the things that the pioneers knew was that, and I've got a list here of about 13 things, they used native local plants. They used pass-along plants from friends and family and neighbors. They used recycled bottles for borders and yard art, bottle trees. Of course, that was more prevalent in the South, but upended bottles as borders along perennial beds. They really loved reseeding annuals that didn't have to be purchased every year, and they could save the seeds from the petunias, poppies, larkspur, coxcomb. They had proven perennials that didn't have to be purchased each year. They had edible and medicinal plants, which were extremely important to them. Fragrant plants, the plants from those days, from the 1800s and early 1900s, many, many, many of them were very, very fragrant. They seldom had grass lawns. They didn't have time to be mowing. They had functional landscapes that didn't get in the way. They did not use pesticides. They were by default organic gardeners. Little or no fertilizer use other than compost or, like I said earlier, the manures and things from the livestock. And they didn't have noisy power tools. So those are some of the things that I like to keep in mind when I'm talking about these pioneer plants. Slide number two. This is a collage I created of some of the most popular pioneer plants in the pink and red family, if you will. Most of these photos were taken, at the Tinsley House in Bozeman, Montana. And if anybody gets a chance to go there, I highly recommend it as one of the finest examples of what pioneer life was like and what a beautiful, abundant garden can look like. You'll see in the center here the beautiful dark red hollyhock, daisies, dame's rocket, sweet peas, pink cosmos, saponaria, which was used for laundry, salpiglossus or painted tongue, little cygnet marigolds, more hollyhocks, and of course the heirloom roses. Just an idea of how beautiful these can be when they're all put together.
Marianne, can I cut in for a second?
Please.
I just want to point out that in my area, Dame's Rocket, which is the top purple cluster, is actually considered invasive. So that one I just want to make a note of so people don't run out and get it and plant it before checking in for things like that.
Right. It is considered invasive, but what I have discovered in most places, unless it's irrigated, it pretty much stays along a fence line. But yes, you're absolutely correct. It is on most invasive lists. But if you look at a lot of these old homesteads, you'll see that it's still lingering. There are other plants you could use instead. Again, they're almost invasive, and that would be like Lunaria or the money plant. Or you can skip it altogether. I have no problem with that. The heirloom classics on slide number three, of course, Bleeding Heart, peonies, which we'll talk about in a minute, the wonderful clove pinks, any of the poppies, the foxglove, lily of the valley, violas, of course, daisies, English daisies, German bearded iris, morning glory, sweet peas, marigolds, any number of these that even aren't listed here. the list goes on, and I continue to work on this and make it longer. Here's an idea of some of the flowers. In the yellow and white category, I like to create these collages so folks can see all of you, you know, a lot of the different options and think about how they might put them together in their garden. The upper left-hand side, you have a black-eyed Susan, a rambling white rose, beautiful heliopsis, the darling little signet marigolds from the early 1800s, of course, sunflowers, a little more sweet peas and marigolds here from the 1800s, nasturtiums, which were often eaten in salads and made into bouquets as well. And then here's a corner of the Tinsley, the herb garden down here on the bottom left side, with the daisies, the old-fashioned petunias, and what's left over of some of the columbines. Slide number five, just a close-up of the exquisite bleeding heart. And I've noticed around town here, I don't know how your weather has been, Eva, but these are blooming already here. My lilacs are opening up full. My wisteria with the last 2 days of 90-some degrees.
Wow.
These things are way early. How are you guys?
Yeah, well, I think we're earlier than some years for sure because my spring snow crabapple is already in full bloom as of this week. But probably just because we're so much higher up, the Dicentra bleeding hearts, sometimes I have trouble remembering the common names. they're not there yet. They're going to be probably another week or two, I would think.
Yeah, mine aren't open because they're in a shadier spot, but driving around town, I've seen a lot of them that are in their full glory,
mm-hmm.
and again, it's pretty early here, so.
Yeah.
The next is a beautiful, beautiful morning glory. I can't remember the name of this one, and I don't have it on any of the documents right in front of me,
amazing.
But, you know, Grandpa Ott's Heavenly Blue. There's so many of these, and a lot of these are available from friends and neighbors, but also one of my favorite places is Select Seeds, and I think at the end of the program today, we have a list of places where folks can look to get the seeds of these heirloom plants. Renee's has also, the seed company, has also put out a lot of heirloom packages. Of course, the beautiful lily of the valley. Now, I know a lot of people will say, oh, my, once you get them going, you can't get rid of them. You know, I say let them run. They are so fragrant. They're beautiful. They can take the dry shade. When they are planted next to some of the pale green and pale yellow hellebores, they make an absolutely smashing combination. And again, it's so often hard to find things for dry shade. This is a perfect plant for that. And they just kind of disappear at the end of the season and come back year after year after year.
Marianne, I tried planting some of those under my crabapple I just mentioned a few years back. And I'm not sure what I did wrong, but I think I probably didn't give them enough water to compete with the tree roots and everything to get started. Like everything else, they need water to get established, right? I mean, a good amount, maybe.
These things will need water to be established, and then after the year or two, they're okay. And one of the very poignant moments in my Antonia is when she tells her friend Jim Burton, they haven't seen each other in a couple of decades, that at night after she'd worked in the fields, she would get up and hand water, carry buckets of water to the trees, the fruit trees, the crab apples, and the pear trees to get them going because she knew that she would need them down the line to feed her family. So, yes, this stuff does need a little bit of tending and that to get established. But, Eva, I would think that maybe one of the problems, I don't know how big that crab apple was,
uh-huh.
They do better under dry conifer shade, maybe.
Oh, okay.
I'm thinking that you might have had them in too much sun.
Okay. Yeah.
Because those lilies of the valley really kind of like at least a half a day of shade.
Good distinction.
Just a thought. Just a thought.
Yeah, it's a good one.
On the next slide, on number 9, these are peonies at my house, or peonies, or pinies, however you want to call them. And these have a particularly memorable part in my life because we would make big bouquets of these, put them in 3-pound coffee cans that had been covered with aluminum foil and drive around on Memorial Day and deliver them to the graves of my family members throughout northern Idaho. And we generally had the big dark red one, which is also called Old Piney, and I don't know the true name for that one, and the white ones and a few of these pink ones. These are luscious. My this pink one right now is just getting little buds all over it, but it hasn't bloomed yet. These will live more than 100 years in one place.
Wow.
So an excellent plant, and they need more sun than people realize. In fact, I would say 6 to 8 hours a day to really bloom beautifully.
I just want to point out to everyone we're on slide number 9 right now, so you can keep up with us.
I've got a problem here. I've got a whole bunch of slides that did not convert properly, and I'm having an attack.
Oh. Well, you can talk us through the names.
Can you see anything here? I'm on slide, I'm clicking through to 22, and it did not load.
You know, slide number 8 is missing, and slide number 10 is missing for me, but 11 is there. 12.
What? Okay, 13. Tell me what you have for 11. I'm going to have to rely on you then.
11 is Dianthus.
Okay, we're going to have to play a little game here where you help me out.
No problem.
Because I can't see anything on my program.
Okay. I'm glad to help you.
The cottage pinks, beautiful. This is in an old garden at a miner's cabin. These were planted in the last few years, but it's the kind of thing you might have found, and they have such a strong clove fragrance, and this is just a handful of the seeds were thrown out, the same varieties you would have found in the late 1800s.
Gorgeous.
So, okay, and my next slide
is foxglove.
Oh, the beautiful foxglove. Very, folks love that. Now, that's one that's really good for kind of moist shade. It needs a little more water than a lot of these other plants that we're talking about. But once it's well situated, it will continue to reseed. It does better at the higher elevations, especially in northern Idaho, over by Ketchum, Sun Valley, and probably in some of the higher mountain towns where you are. Okay, next slide.
Day lily, ditch lily, tiger lily.
Are you able to progress through these okay?
Yeah, so far so good.
Okay, this is funny because I can't see anything.
Oh, too bad. They're really beautiful.
Oh, as you're seeing, okay, so I'm having to rely on this, doing it. Okay. The day lily, ditch lily, tiger lily. Ditch lily is what they're called in the American South. I grew up with them. They were always called tiger lilies. The botanical name is Hemerocallis fulva, F-U-L-V-A. When you start driving around and looking at these old homesteads and barns, you will see these everywhere. My dad used to mow them down after they were done blooming, and they'd come back reliably every single year. At Willa Cather's home in Red Cloud, Nebraska, in fact, these are still growing around the foundation of the house, a very typical foundation planting, you know, in a nice big row. They're beautiful sword-like leaves, practically indestructible. If, in fact, you can have someone give you a clump of them, you can divide them about every other year. They're phenomenal. They don't need any extra water. They're just tough as nails, and they bloom for about 2 weeks. And again, one blossom a day.
I wanted
okay,
to,
next.
Let me ask you real quick about those, Marianne. I see Stella de Oro and, you know, a whole slew of different day lilies at the nurseries these days, but they all seem so much shorter than the plants I grew up with also in Ohio, referred to as tiger lilies. And, you know, common
names.
That's
right.
I don't know if there's a big difference beside common name. I mean, obviously the variety is different, but they grew, gosh, I want to say 2, almost 3 feet tall. Are they just not commercially available anymore, or is it just my area?
I don't think that they are commercially available. They're considered kind of a nobody. And the Stella d'Oro, the reason those have been out, and the Purple Stella, is because they bloom almost all summer.
Mm.
Now, one of the problems we've had in Boise is they've had the Stellas have had a virus, so they have lost way to one called Many Happy Returns. But those are hybrids. These are the good old heirlooms, the old-fashioned ones, and you really do need to get a start from somebody else. And if you need some, I'll send you some because I got lots.
Oh, thank you. I might take you up on that. They're just such a nice, dramatic height sort of accent. You know, I just love that height.
Mine are up hip high practically, if not higher.
How high did you say?
At least hip high, if not higher.
Yeah, they're so cool.
Okay, now I'm getting some of my pictures. So this, of course, is the pale pink. Is that what you're seeing, the pale pink poppy?
Yeah, slide number 14.
Oh, yeah, I love this very, very much. And this was passed along to me by a friend. I don't really know the name of this one either. But, of course, people are really familiar with the bright red and the bright orange ones. They resent being moved, but it's so easy to collect the seed pods and sprinkle those in your garden, and they do really well if you sprinkle them on top of the snow in January and February and let them settle down into the soil, and then they will come up again. These Orientals are absolutely gorgeous and one of the all-time favorites. Ticks, trips, combos, and other mumbo-jumbo, how to use these in a pretty way. Are you looking at slide 17?
I'm looking at 15.
Okay.
But it says that.
Click on through to 17 where you'll see some evergreen trees and the poppies.
Yes. Uh-huh, that's 17. Yeah.
Okay. This is in a very contemporary garden over in Ketchum, Idaho, back along one of the mining roads. And I loved how they used these poppies, the heirloom poppies. And over there to the left is the firecracker penstemon by the rock.
Mm-hmm.
And then the native trees, some yellow twig dogwoods, and then they used a mix of fescue just to keep it easy to maintain. And there is no additional water added to this throughout the growing season. It's either make it or break it.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a couple of blank slides here that didn't upload properly. But if you can get to 19 where it says creating a tapestry.
Mm-hmm. I got that.
Okay. This is beautiful. This is actually in the heart of downtown Chicago. This is the Lurie Garden created by Pete Odolph. And he is really, really famous for using these prairie-style plantings. He's a Dutchman, but he loves the indigenous plant materials of the American prairie. And he likes them, what he says, dead as well as alive. He believes plants should look as beautiful when they're out of season. And so he plants for the beautiful dry grasses and seed heads. If you grow, Baptisia is the blue in the very, very back there, the lighter of the two blues,
mm-hmm.
which is very easy to grow around here. And then the darker thread of blue through the back is Salvia Maynite, which blooms really, really well for me here. There is an Amsonia, a blue Amsonia there kind of to the right-hand side of that photo. And then up close to the very, very front, that pale pink, is Old Man's Whiskers or Geum Triflorum. And mine are just now starting to bloom. I love that dainty, dainty little plant. Absolutely hates too much water. I would say any of these plants, too much water, and you'll lose them. And that's one of the beauties of these is they really resent being overwatered. On the prairie, they were used to a big blast of water and then long, hot, dry spells. One of the things, I know you had Pat Hayward on.
Yes.
Plant Select. And one of the things I love about the Plant Select plants is so many of them resent too much water,
mm-hmm.
which is so important for us here because water is such a critical issue.
Exactly.
Up close and personal, the German bearded iris. I don't know, it's becoming maybe my all-time favorite flower. Smells like great bubblegum. Here is a beautiful one if you've gotten up to slide 21. The higher altitudes, which I know Colorado is famous for the your quaking aspen, and then this beautiful blue German iris. There are three particular German bearded iris, bearded iris, that are famous in the heirloom gardens. There's a pale yellow one that tends to be more from, you'll see more of it from the eastern side of Colorado out to Oklahoma and into the southeast a little bit. It's Iris flavescens. And you will see stands of those along highways that are maybe a half acre long. That's the pale yellow one. Then there is the deep purple one that I just showed you in that close-up, and that's Iris pallida. And then you have the tall medium purple, and that's Iris germanica, the one in this picture. And, of course, this one is the one that smells like grape bubblegum. Here's a picture of how these are used in a contemporary setting, plants are used. This is at the English Garden at the Idaho Botanical Garden, which I had the good fortune of overseeing the installation. We use these heirloom roses. They're pale pink. This is New Dawn. It's not, actually, let me rephrase that. It is not an heirloom rose, but it's meant to mimic the look of the heirloom rose. But then we back planted there behind the fountain and by that chair, you will see the Centranthus rubra, Jupiter's beard in pink and white. Great plant. Once it's established, it just does really, really well. It's in shades of everything from a deep red, soft pink to a pale white. And behind that are all the peonies and stuff in a collection. And I've got more examples here to show you. Here's the Centranthus rubra. It is stunning when it's planted in mass. Here it is, and you can see how much darker red it is in different soil. This is at Red Butte Garden in Salt Lake City. Tough, tough, tough plant. I noticed that I'll see this start to bloom here in the next couple of weeks. And it will be blooming in some way, shape, or form until the first part of July. I am going to experiment with cutting mine back this year to see if I can't push a second bloom into autumn.
That's great. And that's slide 25 we were just looking at with a bright red.
Correct. Jupiter's beard. And now is a drop-dead red garden. This has the red poppy and Japanese maple and some other old heirlooms in this garden. This is in the north end of Boise. And then slide 27 is the prairie penstemon and the old pink rose. And I couldn't find a name on this old pink rose, but it's an heirloom before 1876. Wildly fragrant. In Boise, we're having a huge issue with a virus in our roses, and it has pretty much decimated most of the hybrid rose varieties. The ones that don't seem to be affected are any of these heirloom roses, the old-fashioned varieties. They're doing really, really well. Granted, they only bloom real heavy in May and June, but I think it's worth it because they have such intense fragrance, and the blossoms are just unbelievable. Again, I included this collage slide just so folks could get an idea of how you can mix these different plants together. all of these were blooming at the same time at the Tinsley House in Bozeman, and I wanted people to think about putting them together in their own gardens, maybe with the exception of that Dame's Rocket. But you'll see here to the left is an heirloom rose. You have daisies. We'll skip the Dame's Rocket. Sweet peas. Cosmos, both of which are annuals. The saponaria or soapwort. The hollyhock. The painted tongue or salpiglossis. And then another paler red hollyhock. With the exception of the roses and the daisies, these are all really lovely annuals, very affordable to grow. Here's a combination in the blue, white, and green, the bearded iris. The blue geranium is just starting in the very front here, and the blue baptisia. For folks that like blue and white, this is a gorgeous combination of these heirlooms and how you can use them in your garden. Here's another contemporary but farmyard look. I love here on slide number 30 where they put that beautiful wrought iron chair back in there. And they have the different catmints, the irises. The tall, plumey-looking thing is Aramiris or foxtail lily. And a few lupin in there. And this would do really well in some of your higher elevations where it doesn't get too hot. The yellow combination. Pardon?
I was just going to interject, you're so right about that, about them doing well at a higher elevation, and especially Aramiris is one that Panayoti talked about and highly recommended, should be everywhere and is all over the Denver Botanic Gardens. It's a beautiful one, so it's nice to see that again.
It was Panayoti and our horticulture guy here, Rod Burke, in Boise at the Idaho Botanical Garden. They both first got me going on the Aramiris or foxtail lily about 6 or 7 years ago, and Brandt of Brandt and Becky's Bulbs, and I recommend that as a good source because they aren't, you don't always find those in your local nursery centers. When you get the roots for these, they look like a mop. And you do need a kind of a big hole, but my heavens, when they grow, they're 6 feet tall, and they're just breathtaking. Mm-hmm. And in our dry American West, they are an outstanding plant. So I recommend everybody try at least 3 of those next year. Here again, we just glance at the yellow combination with the nasturtiums, the white roses, the rudbeckias, the heliopsis, and the daisies. Here's a beautiful combination. This has the silver artemisia as a backdrop with the evergreen. To the left is the orange butterfly weed, a hybrid penstemon, the Husker Red penstemon, and then to the right you can see some lavender, and back behind the lavender is a firecracker penstemon. Idaho has 200 and some varieties of penstemon, and I don't know how many Colorado has, but boy, you can start planting those once you start paying attention to them and look at the native plant sales and that kind of thing, and you can plant them so they will bloom in your garden from about the end of May all the way through till October. I highly recommend penstemon. I think they're one of the best Rocky Mountain plants there are.
Yeah, we have, I think, and upwards of over 60 different species that are native to Colorado. And, of course, I'm sure you know, Marianne, there's the whole penstemon society, too, because there are so many great selections. People just love them.
I love that. I'm a member of the penstemon society. And there's another one, too, that I really encourage people to join, and that's the Areogonum or buckwheat society in your state.
I knew you were going to say that, and Bill Adams just talked about that in his talk last week. It's great stuff to know about.
Oh, we're plant geeks, and we're thinking along the same line.
Yeah, I love it.
We can't get away from it once we get going.
I know it.
And our native plant sale is this Saturday, so if anybody from Boise is listening, go, go, go. Mm. And they're going to have a bunch of penstemon. Here's a beautiful planting. I think this would also look really, really good back with the aspen and the baptisia and the iris that I showed a minute ago. This is Campanula glomerata. This is an old variety in front of a beautiful steel blue spruce and Alcamilla mollis, or lady's mantle. Just a yummy, yummy blue, silver, lime, green. I know folks love that combo. Here's another planting. This was at one of the gardens in Utah. And this has Veronica and Campanula. And the kind of purplish pink in here is the hardy homestead purple verbena, which spreads and grows like crazy. I love that. I'm just now getting started with that in my garden. And then the purple penstemon, or the blue penstemon in there, Rocky Mountain Strictus.
That's slide number 34.
Right. And now switching to 35, if everyone can get along here with me. Vegetables. This is at the beautiful vegetable garden in Bozeman at the Tinsley House, which, again, I can't say enough nice things about this place. The folks from Zone 4 magazine and I, Andra and I, went last year when they were just wrapping up for the season, and we still had a fantastic time. But this is such a great example of what folks can do at home. And, again, most of these, this vegetable garden, of course, everything in here is an annual. The artichokes, the corn poppies, the cosmos, the squash, the cucumbers, the corn. They make these beautiful trellises with just the twigs and stuff. I love this piece about the edibles. Here's another photo of edibles. This is from the Denver Botanic Garden, the red chard, the yellow calendula, and then the Gomphrena fireworks, which is an annual flower for bouquets, but this just looks pretty just all mixed together. That's slide 36. Back at Red Butte Gardens in Salt Lake City, and I was just trying to give folks that are watching today and following along some ideas of the different combinations you can create with these drought-tolerant and mostly heirloom plants. This, of course, is a hybrid rose to the left, but I love that kind of orange sherbet color. And then I'm hoping folks can see this better on their screen than I can on mine, but there's that white foxtail lily kind of to the center of the right here, and it is, again, 6 feet tall. And to the right of that, the yellow plant is the Phlomus russelliana, or the Jerusalem sage. And that is so drought tolerant. And that pale yellow is really, really pretty in the garden. One of my favorite all-time plants, this is orange globe mallow. It also comes in a pale watermelon pink, and I've seen it in also kind of a cherry red color. This plant hates too much water. I cut mine back twice a year after these big blushes of bloom, and it just comes back, and it's usually still blooming at Thanksgiving.
Wow.
Of course, the beautiful Indian blanket flower. This is a hybrid, but there are now, oh gosh, at least a dozen different variations on this. I think I've got a picture of the native blanket flower here. This is another plant that too much water and it'll disappear and never come back. Indian paintbrush, difficult to get started, but once you do, it's so beautiful and subtle. In our orange theme, back to our daylily, ditch lily, tiger lily. Oh, here's the Gallardia burgundy. This has mostly red with just a little tiny tip of orange around the edge. Oranges and lemons, Gallardia, with the Angelina sedum. Oh, I hope you can't see that little note. Anyway, can you see the sulfur buckwheat?
Oh, yeah, slide 44.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Isn't that a sweetie?
It
I love it. This is back in Utah at the Waterwise Garden with the Russian sage, the Jupiter's beard back here, the Centranthus, Mormon tea in the background. In the front is the Missouri evening primrose. Another one in Utah, this is at the Red Butte Garden with the great old-fashioned yellow yarrow, the Campanula glomerata, the white David phlox there to the left, starts blooming early, very, very fragrant, and one of the phloxes that is not prone to mildew. If you have a really bad year, you can get it, but it doesn't usually succumb to mildew.
And that's slide 46, Marianne?
Right, and now I'm on 47, which is just a little farther down that garden path. And again, these plants, if anything, get watered maybe every couple of weeks, if at all. Matilaha poppy or Coulter's poppy in Utah, gorgeous thing. This is one of my favorite photographs. This is the Columbine Formosa, little lanterns, but this is grown on the rooftop of the LDS Convention Center in downtown Salt Lake City. They created a beautiful alpine garden there and were up literally three or four stories in the air, and I just love the way these were waving in the wind. Here's more of this, the penstemon, the asters. You can see the little columbines in the back. All of these are just doing their thing, blooming their little hearts out up here on the fourth story. Back to Red Butte again. And this is a plant that I let go crazy in my garden, and that is showy milkweed to the right. It's fantastic for pollinators. And I actually encourage this. I've picked up the seed pods and moved this around my garden a little bit so I have the butterflies that come for it. And I want to make sure I've got bits of it in my garden, all around the garden for the pollinators. This is just a pretty combination. I like the white rose and the blue spruce. And blue spruce, you know, are so common where we are. Santalina in yellow and silver, they come in both varieties, great with the rock garden look. Paprika, yarrow, or achillea, another great plant. Some folks are a little bit troubled by it when it's on their skin, so beware of that. Firecracker penstemon and the gorgeous chocolate flower, the little yellow daisy here in the front. If you hold that up to your nose and smell it, it definitely has the fragrance of chocolate. Mm-hmm. Wonderful daisy. Both of these plants, again, resent being overwatered. I bet I've had more trouble with my husband over the last 5 years about fighting over water and not watering. There's something about a man with a hose. He seems to think that they need his help. I'm getting there, though. I'm making progress.
Well, one thing I've learned, Marianne, a teacher of mine said this once, and I thought it was really brilliant, a brilliant thing to point out and shift of a way of looking at things, is that water here does not equal love. You know, we want to think that if we love our plants and want
Absolutely.
To nurture them, we need to water them a lot. But if you're growing the right plants for our area, it's not so, and you can actually hurt them by watering them too much. So
That's the absolute truth, and you'll find here in the nursery industry, mm-hmm. people will tell you at the independent garden centers, we kill more plants with love here, mm-hmm. meaning with the garden hose,
yeah.
than we do by grass.
Yep.
So, yeah, back off on the water, folks. Yep. Gorgeous rambling roses. The joke is in Boise, Idaho, we're the city of trees. We should have been the city of roses until we had that virus, because they love the dry air here. But these old ramblers, really, just let them go. Let them climb over fences. That's how they were meant to go. And as you saw in that very first slide of the old abandoned mansion, that yellow rose has been there since 1895, and no one's taken care of it.
Wow.
Here's another version of yellow wild rose. And this is a picture. This is towards Oklahoma. I love this with the Queen Anne's lace and the ditch lilies in here, just allowed to fill out that entire meadow. This is a great example. This is in North Idaho. This bed of irises, at one time this was all set up in beautiful little squares with paths and stuff. And these iris have been here now for 50 years, completely unattended. That road used to be the main north-south highway in Idaho, and it isn't anymore. They moved away from that onto a new road about 35 years ago. And I drove up here about 3 years ago to see if the iris were still there, and they are, with no one looking after them, no one watering them. And I just want to thank everybody for listening today, and I'll answer any questions that folks might have. If you'll run, be my MC.
Yeah, actually, we don't have it set up that way to take live
Oh,
questions.
okay.
So,
Okay.
yep. And let me see what else I wanted to talk to you
On the handout,
about.
can folks see my additional reading? I
Yeah.
had American Household Botany, Restoring American Gardens, Old House Gardens for Historic Bulbs, Select Seeds, the Tinley House in Montana. There are a couple of places that have been pointed out to me that are also really good places to see old gardens or what has survived. When I spoke at the Denver Botanic Garden, people told me, actually, it was Jody Torpy of Western Gardeners, that there is a nice historical exhibit of the soddies, the sod shacks, east of Denver, and what they garden with there. And then someone else pointed out to me too that there was a really great collection of plant material at the old experimental station near Cheyenne.
Yeah, I
Now,
want
whether or not that's
Sorry. Yeah, I just wanted to actually mention that at some point to you on this call, Marianne, was the Cheyenne Field Station. Have you been there yourself?
That's it, and that's it, and that's where I'm going in about a month.
Yeah, you might be able to fill in some of the details here, but that it sounds like just such an amazing thing. I've heard a few different talks on it, and I know at least I haven't looked lately, but in former years there were field trips being led up there from and through the Denver Botanic Gardens. And the whole gist of it is, I'm kind of making part of it up from my the shreds of my memory with it, but I think some wealthy person perhaps, or some scientific endeavor was wanting to experiment with all of these plants that were brought from all over the world for their adaptability to this area and their toughness. And now it was abandoned like 60 some years ago, roughly,
Right.
and now there's still a lot of those plants thriving. It is being cared for again, but the point is that no one was caring for it in any way, shape, or form for decades. And many of those plants have persisted. And so it's very exciting to now go back and look at what those are and draw from that as a resource for horticulture. So go ahead and correct me if you know different or better on any of those
Hey.
points.
No, but I would also welcome any comments from any of our listeners today if they would like to comment or, send me a note. And I don't know if you put my email up there, but you're welcome to.
Okay.
And I would love to hear what they have to say about it or if they know when the next field trip is or who to contact. I had a couple people come up to me at my talk in Fort Collins last month and mention this, and so it's on my list of must-do in June.
Yes. Yeah, and I actually was interested in finding a speaker to talk for this series about that, and I just never followed up on that, but that may well be a talk that we'll feature going forward here with the education component in whatever form it may take. So
I would love to. I would love to participate in that as a listener, so you just let me know.
Okay, I will. And, yeah, I will make a point of getting Marianne's information available to you all for that so that you can be in touch. So we'll do that. Maybe I'll put it in the
I'll do my very best to answer anyone's questions that they have.
Great.
And I appreciate any tips they might have for me, too.
Great. Yeah, I'll put that in the replay email we'll be sending out in a couple hours here to everyone. I'll make a note so I don't forget real quick here. So also for our audience today, I just want to point out that I should have highlighted it at the start of our talk today, but Marianne did make a very nice handout that we put a link for in the email that went out yesterday announcing her talk today. There was a separate link from the link that talks about the replay and for the slideshow today. And it says very clearly on it, handout, so you shouldn't miss it if you look for it. That will be yours to keep and refer to. So thank you for preparing that for us, Marianne. And
I'm sorry if I didn't update the date on that.
It looks good.
Anyway.
Yeah.
The handout is important, not the date on it.
Yeah. Oh, the date. No, it looks good. And then you have a book out that I have listed in my carousel for people to be able to access easily. That book is Rocky Mountain Gardener's Resource. Do you want to tell us anything about that book?
Well, it has not yet been published. It was written, put together a year and a half ago, and it includes the work that's already out there. It was an update of the Rocky Mountain Gardener's Guide that was done by your local garden hero, John Creddy, and it includes the vegetable component by Bob and Cheryl Goff from Bozeman. They wrote the Rocky Mountain Gardener's Vegetable Guide.
And Cheryl LeBeau, speaker of the series.
Yeah, I saw that. I saw that.
Yeah.
And it should be out someday soon, I'm hoping. Mm-hmm. And I'm also working right now on another project, 12 months, eating from the garden 12 months out of the year, fruits and vegetables, herbs, and that kind of thing. It doesn't have a title yet, but as soon as we know, we'll let the listeners know.
That sounds like a wonderful resource. So that won't just be your typical annual vegetable plants. It'll be any kind of edible we can grow here.
Right.
Great. That sounds really good. And then you have also come out with some software that may be useful to our listeners for their home gardens, is that right, for designing?
Yes. If you go to /logic/logic.com, you can actually go in there and play around without subscribing. Garden Logic is an online garden design software program that in about 7 clicks of the mouse, you can create a perennial border for your home. We incorporated 260-some almost bulletproof plants, if you will, things that would do really, really well in zones pretty much 5 through 8. We've got some zones 4. We're still working on developing zones 9, 10, and 11 and what we can grow in zone 3. Mm-hmm. And we'll continue to develop that and roll it out. People can subscribe if they'd like. And just go take a look at that and see their pre-made gardens they can have for free.
Yeah, it's very lovely. I played around on it just a little bit. want to delve into it much more, but it looks like an amazing resource. So thank you for developing
that.
Thank
you very much. Great fun. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks so much for being with us today. It was really excellent, and we really enjoyed the eye candy of all of your wonderful photos and learned a lot. Thanks so much.
You bet, and I hope folks have a beautiful day in the garden out there. It's glorious here.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.